Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the most significant challenges for the students, faculty, and staff of the Dallas Independent School District, and what can stakeholders expect in the coming months and years? The DISD currently serves more than 150,000 students in pre-kindergarten through high school under the leadership of Superintendent Mike Miles, who joined the district last summer after leading public schools in Colorado following a career in the military and the U.S. Foreign Service. We've invited Mike Miles to join us this afternoon to talk about his tenure with the district thus far, his sense of the current state of the DISD, and about his plans for future improvement as outlined in an ambitious initiative called Destination 2020. Mike Miles, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You've been at DISD for 6 months now. Talk about what you have learned in your time on the ground that even the best preparation beforehand couldn't have told you.
Well, I've been in a lot of schools over the last 6 months. I think I'm up to 90 schools or so. And so I like to be in the schools and I like to be in the classroom. And I think when you're looking at change and transformation, being in the classroom in the schools is important. So when I talk about what I see, it's from that lens. And I see teachers stepping up and doing a great job and making some of the changes that we have instructionally. I see principals doing a great job in the schools. I'm really impressed with the students, and they're good students. They're well behaved. We have kids who are trying to learn and trying to get college ready. So I see a lot of progress in the school district over the last 6 months. Obviously, we can talk about challenges at some point, but that's what I see every day.
When you go into a school, it reminds me of my former career as a television news reporter, where the presence of you and your camera, in my case, sort of affects things a little bit, even if you don't want them to. Knowing that the superintendent is coming for a visit has to put everybody on their best behavior. How do you sort of see past people trying their best to do their best and to impress you?
Mm-hmm. We have some very specific expectations around classroom instruction. And so we look very specifically at several things. We look at lesson objectives, demonstrations of learning, multiple response strategies, and purposeful aligned instruction for a start. And so those things we've trained on and we're looking very specifically for. And so when I come, and almost always it's unannounced, I'm looking for those things. And I know sometimes it raises the stress level of people in the building. I don't yell or scream or anything like that. But, I understand that people want to do a good job when visitors come and when the superintendent comes. And so we look at those things, and I'm very impressed with the progress that I see. So I think in the end, the teacher has to make sure that the quality of instruction is great. That's what they prepare for, 180 student-teacher contact days every year, and that's what I'm looking at.
So we learned last week that of 456 unacceptable public school campuses in Texas, nearly 8% are in DISD, and I recognize that those numbers come from before you joined the district, but talk about the challenges that you see and the things that really can't wait for improvement at this point.
Right, so we've made a lot of gains over the last several years in Dallas ISD. We can be very proud as a school district. I think one statistic that really I think we're most proud of is the graduation rate at 77% right now, when even 5 years ago it was at 62 and lower in years past. So that's really important. But at the same time, I think we really do need to see that there's a long way to go. There's a lot that we have to do with regard to getting kids college and career ready. And the list that the Texas Education Agency put out just last week kind of highlights how the distance we have to travel. We have 35 schools on that list, and we know we have some schools that are struggling and kids who are struggling to be college and career ready. And so that's the real challenge, is to make sure that we have 223 high-performing schools, not just our magnets, not just our town views, but all of the other schools and the classrooms that we have in those schools where kids are struggling. We have to make sure that all of our kids are college and career ready.
When you see a school that is rated unacceptable, do you look first at the administration? Do you look at the quality of instruction from the teachers? Is it a combination? Do you also have to factor in things that the school has no control over, poverty at home and transience among the student population, that sort of thing?
I think all of us recognize that there are a lot of factors that go into educating a student and getting a student college and career ready. We know we have to have collective impact. That means not only what the school is doing, but also how the community is supporting that school. But I look most at the quality of instruction. I think that's a variable we have the most control over, but it's also a very, very important variable in the education of a child. We know from research that teachers make a difference. Our excellent teachers, our strong teachers, our proficient teachers make a huge difference in a child's life. And so we have to ensure that that's the area we focus on first, the quality of instruction in the classroom. And then we have to look at some of the other variables. You have to have a strong principal. Over time, a school with a lot of good teachers can still provide a great education for children, but it won't maximize its effectiveness without a strong principal, a principal who's proficient and effective. And so we're looking at strong principals as well. And then we have to look at parental involvement. One of the lessons of the 21st century reform movements is that you have to have engaged parents and an engaged community, as well as have great quality instruction in the classroom. And so we're looking at different ways to engage parents and also to have this notion of collective impact with community partners.
Talk a little bit about the education that you're trying to provide for principals. You want to send, is it 50 a year through this academy for leadership?
Well, we haven't determined the number for next year yet, but it'll be close to that number. And that the School Leaders Academy, that's the program you're talking about, is for us to develop future principals, future assistant principals, and then future leaders. And one of the things I think every good organization has is leadership density. So we have to expand our leadership capacity at all levels, not just among administrators, but also among teachers, department chairs. We also need leadership density among our support staff, because we know that the support staff contributes greatly to the education of kids, sometimes indirectly, but sometimes directly. The bus driver is the person a kid speaks to first. Oftentimes, the adult in his, on his daily route to school. And so we need leaders among our bus drivers or among our nutritionists. So the Leadership Academy, the School Leaders Academy, is one aspect of expanding leadership capacity in the district.
Is it possible for someone to be a stellar teacher and really not be particularly skilled as a principal, even with the right training?
Yes. Being a great teacher is an important skill for an administrator, but the opposite is not always true. You can stay in the classroom and be very effective and continue your career as an educator, and that that's what we need for many of our teachers to do. We do not want our strongest teachers to go into administration all the time. I mean, it's okay because we also need some strong administrators. But the two do have different skill sets. Leadership, though, is one common skill that they both should have.
How do you want principals to regularly evaluate teachers? That's one of the things that's been stated in the goals of Destination 2020, is that it sounds like a lot more teacher observation than has taken place in the past.
I think just like most people, when we get evaluated, we want there to be clear expectations for what we need to do, and then we want good professional development around the things we have to succeed in. Then we want good coaching. We want coaching and feedback so that we can improve our performance. And only after you have those things in place can you really be assessed or evaluated. And so what we're trying to have all of our principals do for teachers is make sure the expectations are clear, make sure there's good professional development, and then there has to be good coaching and effective feedback. And that means you can't wait till May or the end of the year to walk into a teacher's classroom, sit down for 45 minutes, watch what's going on, and then call that a fair evaluation. And you can't even do that twice in the year and call that a fair, accurate evaluation. You have to be in the classroom pretty regularly to see what is going on there. You have to have outlined the expectations and then provide good coaching and feedback to our teachers before we can call that a fair, accurate, and rigorous evaluation.
So how much investment in struggling teachers makes sense before you decide that it's not working and it's really time to sort of end that relationship?
That varies depending on the person. I mean, I think we have to see progress, no question about that. And we have to have strong progress towards proficiency. Once you become proficient, then the timeline can change because that is the bar. That's the goal. But I would hate to say that it takes 3 years or 2 years or 1 year. In some cases, the trajectory is so flat that we might say that that person should not teach kids further than a year. But in other cases, trajectory towards proficiency is high. The teacher is making good progress. Kids are still learning. And so we should continue to develop that teacher for several years.
You worked as a teacher before you went into school administration, is that right?
That's correct.
How long did it take for you to feel like you knew what you were doing in the classroom?
I don't think I ever learned all the things I needed to learn, okay? Mm-hmm. And I taught for 4 years. I can tell you my first year as a teacher was the toughest job I've ever had. I've had a number of tough jobs in my life, and the second toughest job was a middle school principal, but the toughest job was first year teacher. And this was 1995 in Fountain, Colorado. I was a ninth grade teacher. That was my first teaching job, and I had just left the U.S. State Department 6 months earlier, and it was my first classroom. I hadn't student taught or anything. I walked in my first classroom, and I didn't know what I was doing. And I struggled for several months. And I think the turning point for me was when I finally realized that it wasn't the kids who were not getting it. It was the way I was teaching. I didn't turn the mirror on myself and say, look, if they're not learning, you're probably not teaching well. You're not using the right strategies. I don't think kids come to school and intentionally try not to learn. And I was blaming them a little bit for not doing their homework or not paying attention or not getting it, even though I had taught it. And so when that flipped for me, everything changed. I started changing my strategies. I made things more relevant. I started assigning homework that was doable, but also could stretch them just a little bit. I started changing, looking at different ways of teaching and different strategies I could use to engage kids. And so I don't know if I ever, even that year, I didn't learn. I'm sure I didn't learn everything I needed to know to be even a proficient teacher. And I don't think I've stopped learning this with regard to teaching.
My guest is Mike Miles. He is superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District. We are talking about the state of public education in Dallas as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone lines are open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to Mike Miles, who is superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District, about the state of public education in Dallas. This is all part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. So we have to talk a little bit about this audit, this internal audit. This was a check of hiring practices, management practices under your leadership. You call that a witch hunt. The sort of most recent draft has been toned down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Why did it feel like a witch hunt to you as opposed to an investigation of things that maybe didn't make some sense to people?
Mm-hmm. I think in the end of the day, the audit was, as any audit is good, to discover some things that we can do better. And I think that that was the result in this case as well, that the audit showed some practices that we can improve upon. And if you read the management's response, you can see some of the things that we think are going to be improved upon over the next year.
I know one of the things that one of the deliverable promises is that codes and standards for hiring have been tightened up to the extent that things are going to be delineated on consulting contracts and things like that. Does some of that get in the way of you being able to sort of come in and do your job, or is it reasonable that the district wants you to follow standards that were set before you arrived?
I think it's reasonable for people to look at past practices and say, to the extent possible, we're going to follow those. And where we deviate from those, that there's a clear explanation for it. And I think that's the key point, is when there are some things that we deviate from past practices from, then to slow down, explain those, show how we're going to deviate them and deviate from past practice and what the rationale is. And I think that's what was asked for us to do.
Do you think there's a morale problem among the teachers in the school district?
You know, I think morale is something you always have to pay attention to, especially in times of change and especially in the education world that we live in. I think if you look at every major school district across the country, you know, that's a consideration. So are there concerns about morale? Certainly. And those are things we have to be sensitive to and things we have to continue to work on. And even when you think you have high morale, you know, if you dig a little deeper, there's always things that you can do to improve. And so we have to improve our teacher morale and staff morale, and that's something we're sensitive to.
One of the goals I know of Destination 2020 is that students, and you mentioned this earlier, graduate from high school either college ready, which I think most people understand, or career ready. What does career ready mean? And is any high school graduate in 2013 truly ready for a sustainable middle class income career?
I think that's one of the things we're looking at closely. If you look at Destination 2020, we're trying to work with business leaders and other employers to define what career ready means. I mean, we're looking at the year 2020 workplace, the year 2025 workplace, and in those environments, it's different. Some of the things that kids need to know and be able to do. Some of the things people are already telling us, for example, is that they want graduates who can work in teams. They want graduates who can communicate with adults. They want graduates to show up on time. They want graduates who understand workplace protocols. They want graduates who are more technologically savvy and literate. They want graduates who critically think more than what we've had in the past, things like that. So we're in the process of defining what that career-ready graduate looks like.
To the extent that students need to be able to work in teams, how can education change from maybe what you and I experienced when we were kids to accommodate that while also ensuring that every student is sort of putting in his or her fair share?
Mm-hmm. One of the things we try to emphasize in our schools is this notion of student pairing or students working in groups, but having some defined responsibilities in those groups so that a kid just doesn't let the rest of the group do all the work and they sit out. And so using that sort of collaborative approach and student-led learning instead of just teacher-driven learning is going to help kids work in teams and have a graduate who's more ready for the workplace in the year 2020.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now. We have Mike on the line in Allen.
Yes. My question deals with the whole issue of proficiency. And I'm sorry, but I missed the very first part of the show, so you may have already defined this. But what is the criteria for a teacher to be proficient? And if it involves test scores, how do you use those scores when a significant number of the students' English is not their first language? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Mike. And Mike Miles, the question was about students who do not speak English as a first language and what can be done to serve them and make sure that we know that teachers are doing what they need to do.
Mm-hmm. There's no one easy solution. We know that we have a growing population of students whose first language is not English. And so the goal at the end of the day is to ensure that kids are college and career ready. And that means we have to ensure that they speak English well and write English well. And there's a number of different research-based processes and programs to allow that to happen. So, for example, in Dallas ISD, we know that bilingual education, especially in the primary grades, in the early years, is very helpful for a student to be able to speak English well in their middle school years. And so that's one of the things that we're doing. We know we don't have enough bilingual education teachers, and we're working vigorously to try to resolve that and get more bilingual education teachers in. But that's a big area, and we look at research to see and our data to see if that's working. And then there's many other programs and processes we can use. For example, there's dual language. There's also co-teaching. But all of it rests on whether or not the student early on is able to speak in two languages and learn in both languages so that by the time they get to middle school, their English is a lot stronger.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Lanisa who writes, "Recently I had to take my 7-year-old to my neighborhood elementary. She was late, and this was before the terrible Newtown tragedy had occurred, but I was surprised I was not asked to sign in, nor were the doors locked. After Newtown, what are your ideas about future changes in security?"
You know, security is an important issue for us all the time, especially now. But we're always worried about, we want to make sure that we have safe and secure schools. We can't have a great education or kids can't learn in an environment that's not safe. And so we've done a number of things on a regular basis. We have the Dallas ISD police force. And after Newtown, the Dallas ISD police force worked with the Dallas Police Department to increase their presence and their visibility. We have at every secondary school we have metal detectors, and at elementary we started to conduct an audit and have finished an audit of all 147 elementary schools, an audit of their security and safety protocols and procedures. And then we also implemented a task force that's an ongoing task force to give us recommendations on how we can improve security. So the caller is right that one of the things that the task force identified for us to invest in is to think about the access point, how you get into a school, and to ensure that there's a way where we can limit that access but also have a buzz-in system where somebody comes to the door, we see their picture, and then we hit a button, and that unlocks the door. And instead of right now where we leave one door open so that people can come into this to the school. So those are some of the recommendations that we are going to be pursuing, but it's certainly something we're all going to continue to pay attention to in our school systems.
Did you struggle at all, Mike? Obviously, we all want every child to be safe at all times when they're at school, when they're going to and from school. Did you struggle with a concern that we also don't want to make them feel as if they are in danger at all times and must be sort of locked away from the world?
That's a great point, and there's a fine balance there because we do not want to turn our schools into fortresses. At the same time, we want our kids to feel safe in school. And, you know, that raises a larger question of security. It's not just the hardware. It's just not the school building. It really is a lot about the people. So we have to remain vigilant. Our students have to remain vigilant. And we have to have good relationships with our students so that we hear about things prior to them happening. And we have to have good relationships with the community and our parents and our police departments.
So we think about the needs of schools and we think of sort of the average student in the average school of average intelligence. How can we better serve the needs of students who have specialized, individualized needs that may not allow them to thrive necessarily in a standard classroom at all times, but who still are capable of finishing high school and getting a good education?
I think that's something we have to continually work at. I think we have implemented a lot of magnet programs and different programs for kids with different needs and also different interests. And I think we need to continue to invest in that. We also need to continue to look at programs like response to intervention, where we look at the specific needs of children so that we can tailor the educational environment for them, but also the content and the curriculum for their needs. And I think that's a process that's ongoing. I think the career ready certificate concept is also going to help, because we identify what a student really needs to work to be successful in the year 2020 workplace, and then we can tailor the program and the curriculum in order to make sure that child gets that level of attention and the curriculum that they need.
Full disclosure for our listeners, I have a child in the magnet system and have been really, really happy with it. But I know that there are people who argue that this amounts to a brain drain from other campuses across the school system and that maybe it pulls resources out of local schools.
I think we have a number of schools that are not magnets that are doing great things with kids on the order of the magnet schools. And I just was speaking to a group of active parents who really want us to continue to advertise and promote Hillcrest High School, Woodrow Wilson High School, W.T. White High School, and other schools, because we have a lot of good things going on. And one of the things we need to do better at is to promote and to advertise the good things that are going on in all of our schools, not just our magnet schools. And yes, you know, there's a balance there. We know we have a way to go in most of our schools, and we know we have work to do, but that doesn't diminish the good work that's going on and the good things that are happening in our schools.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Dallas Independent School District Superintendent Mike Miles. Next on the line, we have Jean calling from Dallas. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I wanted to find out two things. First of all, would it be possible for us to have a liberal-type educational system in DISD? And second, would it be possible for DISD and businesses to have an apprenticeship program, like electrician, welding, plumbing, you know, whatever? I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks for your call, Jean.
On the first question, a liberal education, I think for the most part we are providing a liberal education, and maybe we have a definition, maybe I don't understand the definition, but for me that means we are educating kids in a broad curriculum, not just in the sciences or in math, but also in literature and social studies and the arts. Yes, we have to do even more for the arts. I'm a big believer in pushing our right brain, not just our left brain, and that means we have to continue to invest in our arts and music programs and extracurricular activities and those sorts of things. So I think that's what is meant by liberal education. With regard to the second question,
apprenticeships maybe for students looking at it sounds like trades and other careers.
I think that's exactly the way to go. We need to expand the opportunities that juniors and seniors have to do apprenticeships and internships, dual enrollment with community colleges, and so that we prepare them for the real workplace even before they get out of high school. And we're going to be looking at doing that once we define what career ready means.
When is the best time to identify students who might be at risk for dropping out of high school? Because my understanding is that it is long before students actually reach high school.
I think you have to start in preschool. What I'm saying is we know that if kids leave third grade and aren't able to read at grade level, that's also a risk factor. So it starts as early as that. Doesn't mean we can't recover from that. And it doesn't mean that all kids are going to graduate or leave third grade reading at a proficient level. But we can identify problems early on, and we can invest in our primary grades, and that's going to help as kids move forward.
And in terms of getting parents involved, there are programs that can sort of bring parents in and make sure that information is available to them in whatever language they speak at home. How far can you go, though? What's the limit? You can't get every parent in the school, even if you want them there.
Yeah, you know, we know that if parents are engaged and involved, the success level of their child will go up. It's very important to for a kid's academic success, but also socio-emotional success. And so our job is to encourage and to invite and to ensure that we inform parents about the real need and where the kids are on their academic proficiency. We've encouraged parents to do at least three things. Get their child to school and on time, make sure they do their homework, and make sure they read every day. And we think if a parent will do those three things, it's going to lead to some success for their children.
My guest is Dallas Independent School District Superintendent Mike Miles. We're talking about the state of public education in Dallas as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to Mike Miles, superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. If you've got a question, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phone now and speak with Sharon in Dallas. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Yes, I used to teach many years ago. In fact, I worked for the DISD developing health curricula. And even back then, of course, I don't teach anymore, but back then, all my curricula were based on group learning, not only group learning, but skill-based, where the emphasis is taken off children that compete against each other for grades and the competing against themselves. And what I found, and I took some graduate courses at TWU and had a professor that did exactly that. And what I found was when he took the emphasis off grades so much and worked in small groups that it opened unbelievable creative and higher learning skills, creativity, analyzation, instead of the old memorization type lower learning skills. And I know this can be possible, but it's going to just take almost a drastic overhaul. Because education, in my opinion, is really on the brink of destruction.
Thanks for your call, Sharon. What do you think about all that, Mike?
I think she makes a good point that, you know, we can't have drill and kill and memorization and worksheets, you know, alone. We have to have good cooperative learning. We have to have kids sharing their thinking. We have to have that synergy that comes from kids working in teams. And that's what we try to encourage now with our multiple response strategies in the schools. But she makes a good point about ensuring that we do have some time set aside during the class for kids to learn from each other and also to stress their critical thinking and their ideas with their colleagues.
But when you talk about paying teachers for performance, you're specifically tying that to things like test scores, right? You're not looking at how much a teacher interacts with students or allows them to sort of work in a group setting.
We're looking at multiple measures. So one of the biggest measures is the quality of instruction. And so we can look at how kids are interacting, how engaged kids are, and that's a big part of a teacher's performance.
Even if test scores are not improving?
Right. So it's a combination. Down the road, we will look at both, right? The performance in the classroom, how they write their lesson plans, how they engage kids, how well their instruction is, how cooperative it is, how much critical thinking and rigor there is. But then also one part would be multiple measures of student achievement results. In the end of the day, we have to have kids' proficiency increase. Mm-hmm. That's what we have to have. It's great if they can work in teams. It's great if they can do all these other things. But if they can't read and write, you know, and do math at the level we want them to, that's going to be harmful to kids. So it's not one thing. It's not one measurement. It's multiple measurements, and it includes both.
Why do teachers get burned out?
I think teachers like to teach and want to be in a school where they feel challenged and supported. And then the third piece is where they have good leadership. Mm-hmm. Challenged, supported, and have good leadership. I think people get burned out when they're at a humdrum job doing the same thing every day. So that's probably not going to happen in the schools that much because we have, you know, it's never going to be boring. But they also get burned out if they're not supported. And if there may be high expectations, but without the professional development or the support. And I think people leave also if their immediate supervisor, their principal or assistant principal, isn't a good leader. And so I think that's why people get burned out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have a question here from Katie, who writes, as president of a PTA in one of our more successful DISD schools, I'm hearing great frustrations from teachers. They have to attend so many meetings, it's taking away from their ability to sponsor the student groups, and I've not seen their frustration level this high in many years. Most parents believe in accountability, but we need our teachers to remain involved in after-school activities. If a school is getting a great report card, why not let them do what they do best?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question, and I actually believe that we should let teachers do what they do best, which is work with kids. I think the whole question of how much time we need to spend in meetings and after school, it's a very important one, and we're going to be addressing that topic at our next Teacher Advisory Council. I believe that's in a week, and we're going to be talking about how much time should a teacher spend or after school with the adults, in other words, in a staff meeting or professional development. And we're going to ask the teachers to come up with the answer to that question. And I'm really eager to hear what they have to say, whether it's 60 minutes a week, 90 minutes a week. I don't know what they'll say, but I suspect that's somewhere in the ballpark. We're going to ask the teachers how many minutes before the start of school when class starts at, let's say, 8:30, when should the teacher get there? We're just going to ask them. And then we're going to ask them, well, when the bell rings at 3:30, how long should a teacher have to stay after that bell rings? And I will bet you the teachers will be very responsible, very professional, and they will give us the right answer. They will give us their answer, but it'll be the right answer. Collective wisdom of the teachers is going to give us the answer. And I think we will then end any of this wasted time during too many meetings or too many staff meetings and too many administrivia meetings.
Is the competition from publicly funded charter schools something that motivates good performance in the standard school district? Or is it simply a drain on resources or somewhere in between?
I think somewhere in between is the answer. You know, parents and the community should choose the schools that they want, and they should be good schools. I sometimes think we get in this false argument and fights over, you know, whether it's charter school or public school. We want effective schools for our kids. As a parent, that's what I want. And so, you know, our job is to make sure that we have 223 strong public schools, but we can also learn from other schools. We can learn from Uplift. We can learn from KIPP or Yes Prep or some of these other charter schools. And, you know, at the same time, they have some things to learn from public schools as well. So I think if we approach it in a way of growing in our profession, making sure we have strong public schools, there's nothing wrong with learning from charter schools. And I don't think we need to be fighting that much.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time, our guest is Brett, calling from Louisville. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Mike. Thanks for doing the show. It's really great. My question, primarily, good lead into, was primarily about merit pay. And what you guys had talked about earlier was linking testing. Yet politicians and many experts are even saying that that is an insufficient way to evaluate a school. At the same time, they're saying this is the way we're going to evaluate teachers and potentially close schools based on test scores. And additionally, you know, some of our friends go to charter schools, and my wife is actually an educator in a public school. But, when it comes to charter schools, there seems to be this narrowing of a curriculum that allows for more focus on tested subjects versus a broader education. If you could talk to those points, I would really appreciate that.
Thanks for your call.
There's several good points in the question. So thanks for asking them. Let me try to answer. It's not just about test scores. It's got to be multiple measures of performance. And what makes a good school is not just test scores. We can look at the progress that kids are making. We can look at their starting point and their end point. We can look at some of these other critical thinking areas. We can look at working in teams. We can look at these year 2020 skills. And so there's many things by which a school should be measured, not just test scores. In the end, with regard to merit pay, I know that there's still a lot of research to be done, and I know there's been some confusion around the difference between performance pay and incentive pay and all of that. In the end, though, I think any organization will not maximize its effectiveness if what it values is disconnected from how it compensates people. So if we value student achievement or student proficiency, if we value high-quality instruction, if we value parental engagement, if we value student rigor, if we value what the students think, and if students tell you they're bored, that's something we should listen to, or if they value, if the students tell you they're always engaged, that's something we should listen to. If that's what we value in a high performing school or what we call a great school, then we should find some way to compensate teachers for that. And I think in the end of the day, that's what we're trying to move to. With regard to the whole child and all the other things, I think you're exactly right. You know, I have three kids. Two of them are in college now. But all three of them, we insisted that they play a musical instrument and that they play a sport. That was non-negotiable for our kids ever since they were about seven. And so they could choose the instrument and they could choose the sport, but they were going to do something, because it's not just the books, the reading and the writing and math. It's the other things that can bring a lot to a child's education. Now, I happen to be in a position where I could pay for the music lessons if I had to, or participate, have my kids participate in a team sport. We actually use the YMCA, but we were in that position to do so. And there are a lot of kids who aren't in that position to do so, or families who aren't. So we have to try to help in schools to get them these other activities.
Does the state of Texas give school districts enough autonomy to decide really everything, what they're going to teach and how they're going to teach and when the school year will commence and that sort of thing?
I can say we would like more flexibility on that. When you have 15 end-of-course exams that you have to pass, that does restrict the curriculum a little bit. I'm not against high accountability. In fact, we're bringing more accountability to the district. But at the same time, we really do need to talk to our business community, our other partners out there, our nonprofits, our other employers, and say, what does the year 2025 workplace look like? So I want to be able to focus or at least expand the courses that we have that underscore information literacy or economics or financial literacy or critical thinking with regard to statistics or working collaboratively. Communications is huge. Technology. We should be teaching kids the mobile devices and how to use those mobile devices. Those are all courses that will take some time, and it may take away from some of the other standard curricula that we have. And as you asked earlier, not all kids learn the same, and not all are headed in the same direction. So we have to provide multiple ways for kids to enter a year 2020 environment.
So you've set up a number of sort of deliverable goals for the entire district by 2020. How do you measure your own performance aside from your accountability to the board?
My own personal performance?
Yeah.
The board has set some very good and rigorous performance objectives for me. They have to do with student achievement results, but also operationally and systemically some other performance goals. And so those are the things I have to meet, and those are the things by which I will be measured and assessed.
The last thing I want to ask you is, based on your former career with the Foreign Service, are there things that you learned as a diplomat that you think on a regular basis, thank God I learned this because I really need this as a superintendent of schools?
I think we're all perhaps a product of our past and some of the past learnings. I continue to learn. I think I've learned a lot over the last 6 months here in Dallas, and I'm going to continue to learn so that I can do a better job. I'm grateful for some of the experiences that I've had in the past, either as an Army officer or as a diplomat, and the lessons I've learned in those careers have helped me here, but I continue to learn, and I think that's a never-ending process.
Is there any reason why Dallas couldn't rank among the better school districts in the state, if not the country?
There's no reason. We have great kids, we have great teachers, we have great principals. We have to work more systemically. We have to keep moving and progressing, and we have to set high standards and have high expectations and get ahead of this year 2025 workplace. And I think if we do those things, we will be great.
Mike Miles is superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District. He joined us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Mike, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.